You're listening to an Airwave Media Podcast.
When you need mealtime inspiration, it's worth shopping Kroger, where you'll find over 30,000 mouthwatering choices that excite your inner foodie. And no matter what tasty choice you make, you'll enjoy our everyday low prices, plus extra ways to save, like digital coupons worth over $600 each week. You can also save up to $1 off per gallon at the pump with fuel points. More savings and more inspiring flavors make shopping Kroger worth it every time. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Fuel restrictions apply.
With Lucky Land Slots, you can get lucky just about anywhere.
This is your captain speaking. We've got clear runway and the weather's fine, but we're just going to circle up here a while and get lucky. No, nothing like that. It's just these cash prizes add up quick. So I suggest you sit back, keep your tray table upright, and start getting lucky.
Play for free at LuckyLandSlots.com. Are you feeling lucky? No purchase necessary. Void where prohibited by law. 18 plus terms and conditions apply. See website for details.
This is Kick-Ass News. I'm Ben Mathis. Hi, I'm Ben Mathis. Welcome to Kick-Ass News. For more than four decades, Pulitzer Prize-winning columnist and conservative icon George Will has attempted to discern the principles of the Western political tradition and apply them to America's civic life. Today, the stakes could hardly be higher. Vital questions about the nature of man, of rights, of equality, and of majority rule are bubbling just beneath the surface of daily events in America. Conservatism is under threat both from progressives and elements inside the Republican Party. America has become an administrative state, while destructive trends have overtaken family life and higher education. Semi-autonomous executive agencies wield essentially unaccountable power, Congress has failed in its duty to exercise its legislative powers, and the executive branch has slipped the Constitution's leash. Now, in a monumental new reflection on American conservatism, George Will explains how the Founding Fathers' belief in natural rights created a great American political tradition, and why that tradition now finds itself under threat. It's titled The Conservative Sensibility, and today George Will comes on the show to talk about the book that he says has been ruminating in him ever since his college days at Princeton. He answers the fundamental question, what is it that conservatives mean to conserve, suggests that modern conservatives are losing sight of that purpose, and warns that the movement is endangered by political intoxication and a very different brand of European-style conservatism. George Will takes on the hypocrisy of Christian conservatives and the whole but Gorsuch argument for Trump and makes the case that secularism and conservatism are actually quite compatible. He extols James Madison's belief in the importance of natural rights and the government's role in protecting them, and condemns his fellow Princetonian Woodrow Wilson as the enemy of natural rights and the president who did the most to unravel the founders' vision. Then, this legendary conservative thinker discusses his decision to change his political affiliation from Republican to Independent in 2016, why he just can't make the leap to join the Libertarian Party, and why he believes conservatives would be better off voting for Joe Biden than Donald Trump in 2020. Plus, this avid baseball fan shares his philosophy that baseball is the ultimate expression of democracy on the field. Coming up with George Will in just a moment. My guest today is George F. Will. He is a Pulitzer Prize-winning syndicated columnist based at the Washington Post, television commentator, and the author of more than a dozen books. His latest is a magnum opus of political thought titled The Conservative Sensibility. George Will, it's a pleasure to finally have you on the podcast. Welcome.
Glad to be with you.
Well, George, The Conservative Sensibility is a monumental work. I might even say career-defining. How long have you been working on this book?
Well, 3 years intensely.
Wow.
Because I wrap it around writing 100 columns a year and doing lots of television and all the rest. In another sense, it's the distillation of almost 50 years now as a Washington columnist. Before that, It developed some themes I worked on in my doctoral dissertation at Princeton in the 1960s, the title of which was Beyond the Reach of Majorities, Closed Questions in an Open Society, so I've been brooding about majoritarianism and all the rest for a long time. And I would even say, now that you stir these ashes of my memory, it began growing up in central Illinois. I grew up in Champaign-Urbana. My father was a philosophy professor at the University of Illinois. And according to local lore, it was in the Champaign County Courthouse that Abraham Lincoln learned of the passage of the Kansas-Nebraska Act in 1854. And it was his recoil against this, against the idea that we should settle the slavery question in the territories by popular sovereignty, vote it up or vote it down, that defined Lincoln, who I think was thereby launched onto the greatest career in the history of world politics. So a long time is the answer to your question.
Well, George, I've heard of the conservative mind, I've heard of the conservative heart and the conscience of a conservative, but what is the conservative sensibility?
Well, by sensibility, I mean more than an attitude, but less than an agenda. My intention is not to tell people what to think, but to suggest how to think in a conservative way. A sensibility is defined by how you respond to complex societies and the flux of events in society. Mm-hmm. Are you comfortable with what Hayek called the spontaneous order of a market society, or are you not? Someone once said that the entire Bible reduced to one sentence is God created man and woman and lost control of events. Are you happy with the loss of control? I am. I think that the fecundity of freedom and an open future and the sheer unpredictability of things gives life its exhilaration.
And now, you actually, since you brought it up, you have a chapter on religion in the book, but from what I understand, you're not a religious person yourself. You describe yourself an amiable, low-voltage atheist, I think I heard?
Quite right. My grandfather on my father's side was a Lutheran minister. My father, I'm tempted to say therefore, my father was secular, having seen quite enough of the inside of churches, and he was a philosopher. He used to sit outside Pastor Will's study, and he'd hear the pastor and some of his more reflective members of his congregation trying to reconcile free will and grace. And it was puzzles like this that turned my father into a philosopher. I grew up in a completely secular home. It just
really.
As it never entered the conversation, and I've never felt any need for the hypothesis of theism.
So you were pretty much an atheist from your early youth. This wasn't some kind of revelation that you had in college or later in life.
No, and you used the magic word. I mean, there was no revelation for me. I was there before I read Hume.
In your chapter on religion, you suggest that secularism and conservatism are, in fact, particularly compatible. Can you explain that?
Yes. I'm a Lucretian. Lucretius, who said that change and whirl is the normal, the base fact of the universe, that, in fact, the conservative sensibility is particularly at home with a world that is not planned any more than a market has to be planned.
Mm-hmm.
In looking at society, conservatives say it is just simply not the case that we need a central planner or a designer. And if you look at the world, we don't need an intelligent designer either, for that matter.
Yeah, as a Lucretian, I wonder, when you look at Donald Trump's trade policy and the tariffs that he's trying to put on Mexico and China, does it seem to you like it's just another form of central planning and trying to control that whirl?
Of course it is. What he says is, I want to stop people from Central America crossing the border south to north, and I want to engineer American firms and manufacturers crossing the border from south to mm-hmm. north. It's going to be fascinating. He plans to run against socialism. Protectionism is the essence of socialism. It's big, bossy government telling people what they can buy in what quantities and at what prices.
Mm-hmm.
It doesn't, as is commonly said, it's not that protectionism gives rise to crony capitalism. It is at its genesis crony capitalism. Yeah. It is the obverse of everything that people like me, who may be Lucretians in philosophy, but Hayekians in political philosophy, it's everything we stand against.
Going back to religion, I have to wonder, do you just marvel at the Franklin Grahams of this country and the other Christian conservatives who somehow have managed to shoehorn their values to accommodate President Trump?
No, I don't marvel at them. I've read Elmer Gantry. This is the careerism and fundraising and all the rest of the religious leaders who neglect the Bible's enjoining them, do not put your faith in princes. Mm-hmm. They have more faith in princes, I think, than they do in the divinity.
What's your response to the whole Butt Gorsuch argument for Trump?
Well, there's no question that Donald Trump has served the conservative cause with the judges he has nominated. But the interesting thing is that during the campaign, he said, I promise not to exercise any judgment in this area. I'm going to farm this out to the Federalist Society, of which I, by the way, am a proud member. He's appointed judges exactly of the sort that any Republican president would have appointed. I'm actually quite convinced that if Scalia had not died in February 2016, Trump would not have been elected.
Oh.
According to one exit poll, one in five Trump voters said that the composition of the court was their principal reason determining their vote. And most of these, I think, were people on the conservative side.
It's funny that we're talking about Donald Trump from the outset here, because much of this book, while it appears to address what's happening under the conservative movement under Donald Trump, you don't explicitly mention him in the book. Why not?
His name does not appear in the book, but neither does the name of Charlemagne or Duke Ellington or Audrey Hepburn. This is about ideas, and he's not an idea person.
Right.
And this is not the world really doesn't need another Washington book pouring over every nuance of this man. I find Trump, people say, well, isn't he entertaining? I find him the one thing an entertainer dare not be. He's boring. He's utterly predictable. He has one pedal on the organ, and he works it all the time. Mm-hmm. I wanted to write a book that would say, this is what conservatism has been. This is the distinguished pedigree of its ideas, running back through Lincoln all the way back to Madison, Jefferson, and Hamilton, the Federalist Papers and all that. This is why our departure from it has been a mistake. That's why I think the book is structured around, and I think American political argument for two centuries has been structured around, first Madison and then the progressives' repudiation of Madison by another Princetonian, former university president Woodrow Wilson, who in 1913 became the first American president who criticized the American founding, which he did do root and branch. He said the whole thing is wrong at this point. He said the Madisonian architecture of separation of powers and all that, which Madison designed to make government safe, Wilson said, well, that was fine when we were a small country with 80% of Americans living within 20 miles of Atlantic Tidewater, but now we're a great nation united by steel rails and copper wires, and we need a government, not a safe government, but an energetic, nimble, to use one of Wilson's favorite adjectives, a nimble, strong government under the leadership of an emancipated, unconstrained executive, which is what we've got today. And if everyone's happy, then so be it. I don't think they should be.
Yeah, to the extent that there's a villain in the conservative sensibility, you name President Woodrow Wilson. George, did you feel any guilt about calling out your fellow Princeton man?
No. As a matter of fact, I'll tell you a story. When a couple of years ago, some of the African-American students at Princeton became aware of Woodrow Wilson's extremely retrograde views about race. You may recall the first movie ever shown in the White House was when he had Birth of a Nation shown there.
Right.
And he resegregated the federal workforce. And I called the president of Princeton. I said, you know, I'd be glad to come up and teach these students how to really dislike Wilson. They're not nearly comprehensive enough.
Well, you know, just briefly going back to the fact that you exclude Trump in the book, I just have to say it's rather perfect that you choose to ignore a man who can't possibly stand to be ignored.
Exactly. I sometimes think if my colleagues at MSNBC wanted to drive him around the bend, that's exactly what they do. They'd come on the air at 6 a.m. and go off at midnight and not mention him.
And yet no one seems to be able to do that. No one can make that break, huh?
Well, it's part of the fact that he's such a lurid example, but it's also the fact that presidents have become far too central to the American life.
Mm-hmm.
I mention in the book, in the chapter about presidential government as a consequence of Wilson's critique and the progressives' overthrow of the founders' design, that when Franklin Roosevelt, who of course came to Washington to be Assistant Secretary of the Navy under Woodrow Wilson, when Franklin Roosevelt began his first radio address, his first fireside chat, he began with two words. They don't actually appear in the transcript up at Hyde Park, but the two words he began with were, "My friends." Now, that may sound in this day and age perfectly anodyne, but try to imagine George Washington addressing a group saying, "My friends." It's unthinkable, or Grover Cleveland for that matter, or anyone else prior to Roosevelt, because some of us think it's unhealthy to want the president to be our friend. But what the president actually is the head of one of the three branches of one of our many governments. And his job, as outlined in the rather spare Article 2 of the Constitution, is to take care that the laws are faithfully executed. That's quite enough, thank you. We don't need him to be our moral auditor. We don't need him to be the embodiment of the nation. He's an executive who is as an executive, he's inherently inferior to Congress because he executes what they do.
But don't you think the conservatives lose a lot of credibility when they rail against executive overreach if there's a Democrat in the White House, but then as soon as Trump comes in, suddenly they're just okay with it?
Of course.
If conservative values are completely malleable depending on who's in the White House, then doesn't conservatism go from being a political philosophy to nothing more than a political machine?
Of course. You're absolutely right. I mean, the current crop of Republicans in Congress, it has been well said of them that if they didn't have situational ethics, they'd have no ethics at all. They simply have take a look at what's in the headlines as we speak together. At long last, there's a pulse in Congress, signs of intelligent life, because Republican senators seem to have been pushed too far by the idea of tariffs on Mexican goods, imports into the country. Now, think about this. Congresses under both parties have, for more than 80 years, been divesting themselves of their constitutional powers and giving them to presidents of both parties. The one thing Madison got wrong, he says in the Federalist Papers that the legislature will draw all power into its impetuous vortex, Madison's phrase. Actually, it's been the reverse. Congress has, for 80 years or so, been spinning off powers, leaving the hard decision. They sort of legislate little velleties like we're for a clean environment or competent education, and then they send it over to the bureaucracy and say, you fill in the details. Well, if the court were more robust in enforcing what used to be called the non-delegation doctrine, saying, we're sorry, you just cannot delegate powers that are assigned to you by the Constitution, we'd be much better off. I'll tell you a story. Mm-hmm. If you ever walk into the office of Mike Lee, the very conservative, very able senator from Utah, you'll see two stacks of papers. One's about 3 inches tall, and those are the laws Congress passed in a particular session. Then there's 8 feet of paper, staggering skyscraper of paper, that is the rules and regulations passed by the administrative state in the same period. It's a graphic demonstration of how we are actually, as opposed to theoretically, governed.
is this problem what you mean when you say in the book that conservatism has become untethered from what it seeks to conserve?
Precisely. The sensible question asked of conservatives is, what do you want to conserve? My simple answer is the American founding, the premises of Madison, Jefferson, Hamilton. These were strongly opinionated people who fought like cats and dogs among one another, but they were quite united on the doctrine of natural rights that makes the one word in the Declaration particularly pregnant with meaning. Declaration says all men are created equal, endowed by their Creator with certain inalienable rights, and governments are instituted to secure those rights. It's the word secure. The foundational belief of natural rights conservatism is that first come rights and then comes government.
Yeah, and it's funny because, you know, it seems like we don't talk about natural rights much these days. Why is that? Is it just that Twitter and sound bites on cable news aren't conducive to that sort of serious political philosophy, or why?
Well, what's called social media and should actually be called anti-social media is indeed not conducive to this. But remember, Woodrow Wilson said, do not read the first two paragraphs of the Declaration. He said that is 4th of July rhetoric and can only mislead you because they did not believe, the progressives, that first come rights, then come government. Rights are dispensations from government. Rights are spaces of autonomy granted by government because they are, in the government's opinion, in the public interest. This is the heart of the matter of the Madisonian versus the Wilsonian approach to politics.
Do you think that the current political climate might create something of an opportunity to get some of these basic discussions about things like natural rights back to the table?
I hope so. I mean, I've written this great thumping doorstop of a book in order to do just that.
500 pages.
Yeah, well, I'm decided to believe that this is the most important publishing event since Gutenberg invented movable type, because conservatism is wise and a rich philosophic tradition, and there is no party right now to be its advocate.
We're going to take a quick break, and then I'll be back with more with George Will when we come back in just a minute. If there's something interfering with your happiness or preventing you from achieving your goals, BetterHelp Online Counseling can help. BetterHelp offers licensed professional counselors who are specialized in issues such as depression, anxiety, relationships, trauma, anger, family conflicts, LGBT matters, grief, self-esteem, and more. Connect with your professional counselor in a safe and private online environment and get help at your own time and at your own pace. Anything you share is confidential, and it's so convenient you can schedule secure video or phone sessions as well as chat and text with your therapist. If for some reason you're not happy with your counselor, though, you can request a new one at any time for no additional charge. Best of all, it's a truly affordable option. Kick-Ass News listeners even get 10% off your first month with the discount code KICK. So why not get started today? Go to BetterHelp.com/kick. Then simply fill out a questionnaire to help them assess your needs and get matched with a counselor you'll love. That's BetterHelp.com/kick. It's almost summer, and summer is prime ice cream season. A day at the pool or a Saturday barbecue just aren't the same unless they're capped off with a bowl or a cone of Ben & Jerry's ice cream. For me, nothing beats the heat like a couple of scoops of Ben & Jerry's chocolate chip cookie dough, or three scoops on a really hot day, but then I'm always looking for any old excuse to enjoy ice cream. As a matter of fact, I got in a little bit of trouble with my wife a couple days ago because I snuck some Ben & Jerry's Cherry Garcia for breakfast. Take it from me, folks, the chocolate, the cherries, all that creamy deliciousness on top of a waffle with a little bit of syrup is how to start the perfect day. And here's another tip for you. When you put your Ben & Jerry's in the freezer, hide it behind a big bag of ice or some frozen veggies, because everyone loves Ben & Jerry's, and if you're not a little bit sneaky, I guarantee someone else is going to get to it before you do. Summer and Ben & Jerry's. At my house, the two go hand in hand. Treat yourself to your favorite flavor anywhere ice cream is sold, or find a new flavor at benjerry.com. That's BENJERRY.com. And now, back to the podcast. You came up in the Republican Party of Bill Buckley in the 60s and 70s. Do you recognize the GOP today?
I do not. And I left the Republican Party on June 3rd, 2016. That was the day after Paul Ryan endorsed Trump. And I said, if Paul, who's actually read Hayek and knows what we're talking about in the conservative side, is going to normalize this man, then I'm out of here.
Yeah, and I'll tell you, I did the same thing. I switched my affiliation from Republican to Independent about the same time because I feel right now the country needs to move away from parties and individuals just need to start looking inside and evaluating what their core beliefs are and whether their party is actually in line with those beliefs. Is that part of what you might be advocating in this book?
It is. I'm not against parties. People have different sensibilities, to use the magic word, and they cluster, and we call those clusters parties, and parties give weight and organization to our politics. Nothing wrong with that. The founders did not anticipate parties. They did not want them, and yet the Constitution's ratified in 1789, and the parties emerge in the next decade, and we've been with them ever since. They are inevitable accoutrements of democratic politics. Nothing wrong with that. Mm-hmm. But parties come and go. The Whig Party disappeared, and the Republican Party replaced it. There's a constant moral imperative to think whether or not the party is doing what it says it was founded to do.
And now that you've left the Republican Party, what's prevented you from registering as a libertarian? I mean, arguably, your brand of conservatism has more in common with the Libertarian Party than the current GOP.
Well, there's no question that American conservatism, and the adjective does a lot of work in that phrase, American conservatism is at heart strongly libertarian. I'm sort of a squishy libertarian.
What do you mean by that?
Well, I mean, my libertarianism is simply this, that before the government interferes with the freedom of the individual or the freedom of two or more individuals cooperating together, it ought to have a good reason and it ought to say what it is. Now, that's a basic libertarian impulse, but what distinguishes American conservatism from its European antecedents is that in Europe, the conservative impulse, it rose from blood and soil, throne and altar. It was to preserve hierarchy and order, to preserve established things. American conservatism is to reconcile people to the reverse of that, to reconcile people to the openness of what Hayek called the spontaneous order of society and its constant flux and change, to make that welcome to people because it produces, A, prosperity, and, B, it doesn't make us just better off. It makes us better by giving us a stance toward life that is admirable.
And yet, as we've seen with Trump in London reaching out to Nigel Farage, there seems to be this weird blurring of the lines or confusion between American conservatism and the continental brand of conservatism. Do you see that as troubling?
Yeah, I sure do. I think Steve Bannon, who was, of course, Trump's brain for a while, Steve Bannon, who was part of the Make America Great Again Trump crusade, actually wants to make America European. That is, he wants a blood and soil, ethnically driven, throne and altar kind of conservatism. He wants to import this into America where it really does not belong and has never found firm footing.
And in the book, you write about the perils of political intoxication. That would certainly seem to be a reference to Trumpism. Do you see something about this cult of personality that is fundamentally at odds with conservatism?
Of course. I mean, conservatism is about principles and ideas, not about persons. One would like to think that when, as surely will happen, Trump is no longer with us, that things will snap back to normal. I'm skeptical of this because, as I say, you cannot unring a bell, and the coarsening of our civic culture that he has wrought is not going to just go away. But in fact, I do believe there will be a hunger in America for a more ideas-oriented policy, and it will come.
You just referenced the inevitability of Trump moving out of office. How do you see that happening? Do you think he could lose in 2020?
Or he could lose.
Do you think he's got 8 years in him?
Well, the one thing we know is not going to happen is he's not going to be removed through impeachment and Senate trial, mm-hmm. because the Republican Senate's not going to do this, which is why I'm staggered by the foolishness of Democrats wasting all this time on something they know is not going to bear fruit. It's part of the Democrats seem to be determined to prove that what they did in 2016 was not a fluke, and what they did in 2016 was elect Donald Trump. They were indispensable to this happening. So now they're dashing around saying, here's what we're going to do, reparations for slavery, felons in prison, terrorists included, should be allowed to vote, get rid of private health insurance. That's a curious way to start a political campaign by offending 180 million Americans who have employer-provided health insurance and 40 million more who have private insurance from elsewhere. Abolish the Electoral College. That's not going to happen either. It's absolute certainty not going to happen. Why are they doing this? Because the country listens to them and says, these are very strange people. And we've already got a strange president. Are they trying to outflank him on the strangeness side?
And, of course, there's this very overt embrace of socialism going on in the Democrat Party. Why is that? Why is it that there's this alarming number of Americans that appear to be growing increasingly comfortable with this idea of socialism? Is it just the sheer force of personality of Bernie Sanders? Or what do you attribute that to?
I certainly don't think it's the Sanders personality. Part of it is that they have no clue what they're talking about. Look, socialism used to mean government ownership of the means of production, distribution, and exchange. Mm-hmm. Lenin made a kind of compromise. He says, all right, he says, it's going to be the commanding heights of the economy will be government-owned, heavy industry, telecommunications, steel, et cetera, transportation. Since the Second World War, socialism has been repeatedly watered down until it is approximately this. It means heavy government regulation of the private sector plus aggressive redistribution of income. Well, I have news for you. That's what we've got. 67% of the federal budget is transfer payments. The mm-hmm. sky of America is dark with checks flying back and forth as the government redistributes income. I think the advocates, of course, a lot of the millennials, bless their little hearts, the millennials, I think when they hear the word socialism, they think it means sociability, that socialism
really?
Means everybody being nice to everybody.
Oh, boy.
They don't think of Hugo Chavez, and they don't think of Havana, and they don't think of North Korea or the East Bloc or all the places that socialism's been tried and found wanting. So when they say, gee, let's give it one more try, what they mean is everybody's going to be kind of fuzzy and warm.
Do you think that the part of the problem is just that we don't really have a current example of socialism failing? I mean, yes, you have Cuba and you have Venezuela, but not on the level where we had the Soviet Union.
That's true, although I would I think the second best movie made on socialism is Chernobyl.
Oh, it's so good, isn't it?
HBO.
I've been watching.
It's tremendous. It's almost as good as The Lives of Others, mm-hmm. which is the definitive look at what happens when socialism permeates society.
Yeah, I just actually watched the final episode of it last night, and his speech.
Well, don't
about
tell me. I haven't seen it yet. Don't tell me.
This thing of being a party man and just never standing up for anything is it just really was striking.
I was asked by the New York Times as I was rolling out my book. They have this thing called Buy the Book, and they ask you certain things. And one of the questions they asked was, what book would help us explain, say, the Republicans in Congress? And I said, Darkness at Noon. it's Arthur Kessler's wonderful novel about the purge trials in Moscow in the late 30s. I think it came out in 1940. And there's a character in there called Gletkin, who is the perfect apparatchik. Mm-hmm. a sincere believer that if the party says it, it's true. And if the party says A, it's true. And if tomorrow it says B, not A, that's true mm-hmm. also. And that's the spirit of the Republicans today.
Does it disturb you that so many Americans find their tribe through politics and look to Donald Trump to fill some sort of void in their life? As someone who eats, sleeps, and breathes politics and baseball, maybe not in that order, George, doesn't this strike even you as a little bit unhealthy?
It's not a little bit unhealthy. It's hugely unhealthy. I've often said that I only write about politics to support my baseball habit. people who derive meaning in their lives from politics are heading for the status of true believers. No one reads Eric Hoffer anymore, but in the 50s and 60s, he was a wonderful figure, an intellectual, autodidact longshoreman in the San Francisco Bay Area. And he wrote a wonderful book, he wrote a number of wonderful books, but his first was called The True Believer, about what happens when people are so empty inside and so have such a fragile identity that they have to find their identity in mass movements. And this is what we're experiencing today.
Well, George, I have to ask about abortion. You've long been probably one of the most articulate advocates for the pro-life movement. What do you think about some of the legislation being passed in places like Georgia and Alabama? Should a woman be forced to live with a child that's the product of rape and incest?
No. Look, when Pat Robertson, for Pete's sake, says Alabama's gone too far, Alabama should sit up and take notice. I think it is dangerous to treat preborn infants at all stages of gestation as utterly lacking in moral significance. That's my foundational position. The idea that at no point in gestation does this living being have any more status than a hamburger or a tumor in the mother's stomach is to me not just dangerous and not just offensive, but philosophically untenable. So it seems to me that abortion has always been treated as an issue in which there can be no splittable differences. I don't believe that. I believe that if you look at no nation in Europe has abortion laws as permissive as ours, none. In most European nations, after 15, 18, 20 weeks or so of gestation, restrictions on abortion are quite severe. That would still leave, in the United States, 95% of all abortions unregulated. Let me ask you a question. Suppose the number of months in the gestation of a human infant were a prime number, 7, 11, 13, something like that. So the Supreme Court could not have concocted constitutional significance from the fact that 9 is divisible by 3, and first trimester, second trimester, third trimester. Think of an 11-month pregnancy. Does not tidally break down into trimesters.
And I know that abortion is a personal issue for you because you had to face a similar decision when your son was born with Down syndrome many years ago. Did that shape your beliefs?
I have a Down syndrome son who is 47 years old, and he works in the Washington Nationals clubhouse, which means he gets up in the morning and goes to a major league ballpark, which means he has a better job than I have.
Yeah, Dad must be very proud.
When he was born in 1973, on my birthday, actually, in 1973, someone at the hospital came in and said, well, the first thing you have to decide is whether you're going to take your child home. At that point, it was considered acceptable for people to say, oh, I'm sorry, this child's not convenient, therefore he'll be institutionalized, which is why, by the way, the life expectancy of Down syndrome people at when my son John was born was 20 years. As I say, they were neglected, they were not stimulated, they were warehoused in many cases. As I say, John's 47 and going strong.
Wow. Now, do you think that the more extreme legislation we're seeing in some states might actually end up hurting the pro-life movement with mainstream Americans?
I think it will be. If the Republicans have any more suburban women to lose, this will help them lose them. No, it underscores a complete indifference to a large demographic and mm-hmm. will vastly complicate this. And the laws are being passed often in the hope that this will trigger a reconsideration of Roe v. Wade. I think that is an extremely remote possibility that the court will overturn a decision that has made abortion one of America's most common surgical procedures.
And since you brought up the Supreme Court, I'd be curious, who in the Supreme Court right now or in the past would you say best aligns with your own interpretation of the Constitution?
Well, I'm very fond of Clarence Thomas. He's more of an originalist than I am. Scalia once defined himself as a faint-hearted originalist. But you kind of have to be because of the Eighth Amendment alone. The Eighth Amendment says no cruel and unusual punishments. But if you accepted what was counted as cruel and unusual punishments in the 1780s, you'd be for cropping ears and hip pillorying and flogging and all kinds of things. So no one's a pure originalist. I'm also, I think Gorsuch is extremely good on trying to pare back the deference that courts have mistakenly given to the autonomy of administrative state executive agencies. And I think Brett Kavanaugh also, coming as he did from the second most important court in the country, the D.C. Circuit Court of Appeals, and therefore handling a lot of administrative state questions, is also going to be very helpful.
Well, as we wind down here, I have to ask you about the election. In 2016, you said that Trump was a bigger threat to the country than Hillary Clinton. Do you still feel that way now?
Yes, yes.
2 years on?
Yes, because if Hillary Clinton were president, the Republican Senate would be a stout resister of much of what she wanted. Mm. Supine, boneless wonders who now are the Republican side of the Senate offer no similar resistance to executive overreach.
So looking ahead to the 2020 election, in a binary choice between Trump and, let's say, a more middle-of-the-road Democrat like Joe Biden, what's the prudent choice for a conservative?
Biden.
Really?
That
wow.
is, sure, because then Republicans can go into principled, healthy opposition to mm-hmm. An opposition party is necessary in a democracy. They can hold, if they hold the Senate, Biden as an ex-senator, as an affable, non-angry person, would, I think, help begin to restore something like comity that didn't used to be so scarce.
Yeah. Is there any Democrat in the current field that you would see as the greater of two evils against Donald Trump?
Well, probably Bernie Sanders, because I just have a hard time forgiving someone who chose to honeymoon in the Soviet Union.
Yeah.
And who thinks Hugo Chavez was a really cool guy.
Well, before we go, I have to ask about your two great loves, politics and baseball. Do you think you'll ever write a book combining the two?
Well, no, but I think in the baseball book of mine that sold the most, sold more than my other 14 combined probably, Men at Work, I do say that, I think I say it in there, that democracy is the right sport for baseball is the right sport for democracy because it's the sport of the half loaf. No one gets everything they want. There's an enormous amount of failure. Every team goes to spring training basically knowing it's going to win 60 games and it's going to lose 60 games.
Yeah.
And you play the whole season to sort out the middle 42.
Yeah.
It's a severe meritocracy. At the end of 162 games played in 183 days, you are what your record says you are. It's not a fluke. If you win 10 out of 20 games, you're definitionally mediocre. If you win 11 out of 20 games, you win about 87 games and you're on the outskirts of the playoffs. So it's a severe test, and you can't be a baseball fan unless you can put up with a lot of losing.
But wait a minute, George. How do you explain Fidel Castro's baseball career?
Well, he was overrated. B, he would not have lasted in baseball because he couldn't send people to jail for pitching him inside.
All right. Well, George, it's been such a pleasure to finally have you on the show, and I thoroughly enjoyed the book. I highly recommend it. Again, it's called The Conservative Sensibility. George Will, thanks for taking time to talk to me.
I enjoyed it very much. Let's do this again.
Thanks again to George Will for coming on the podcast. Order his new book, The Conservative Sensibility, on Amazon, Audible, or wherever books are sold. Follow him on Twitter at George Will and look for his regular column in the Washington Post. When I sit down to binge watch my favorite TV show or catch the newest episode, it's always better with a pint of Ben & Jerry's. For me, it has to either be chocolate chip cookie dough or chocolate fudge brownie, because really, when you think about it, you're getting two desserts in one. You get ice cream and cookies, or ice cream and brownies. What's better than that? And Ben & Jerry's has mastered the art of delicious flavor combinations. Cozy up with your favorite flavor, available anywhere ice cream's sold. Or find a new flavor at benjerry.com. That's benjerry.com. Whatever struggles you're facing, from depression and anxiety to trauma and grief, BetterHelp can connect you with a professional counselor in a safe and private online environment. It's so convenient, you can schedule secure video or phone sessions, as well as chat and text with your therapist. And anything you share is completely confidential. Best of all, it's a truly affordable option. Kick-Ass News listeners even get 10% off your first month with the discount code KICK. So why not get started? Simply go to betterhelp.com/kick and fill out a questionnaire to get matched with a counselor you'll love today. That's betterhelp.com/kick. Be sure to subscribe to Kick-Ass News on Apple Podcasts if you haven't already. And if you like what you're hearing, then rate and review us while you're there. 5-star reviews are the easiest way for new listeners to find us. Don't forget to like us on Facebook and follow us on Twitter at KickAssNewsPod. And feel free to email me with your thoughts, questions, and suggestions at comments@kickassnews.com. Until next time, I'm Ben Mathis, and thanks for listening to Kick-Ass News.